on a roll. All right, so agenda paper 5. Back to Hannah.
Yep.
Okay, in agenda paper 5, we're looking at the application of the impairment requirements to guaranteed debt instruments, where the financial guarantee contract held is integral to the contractual terms of the financial asset. IFRS 9 requires that cash flows from such integral financial guarantee contracts held should be taken into account when you're measuring expected credit losses, and it's quite clear in that respect. However, the question we've been asked is whether they should also be taken into account when we're assessing whether the credit risk of the guaranteed debt instrument has increased significantly since initial recognition. And to make such an assessment, IFRS 9 tells us to look at the change in the risk of a default occurring. We note that if you exclude recoveries from your financial guarantee contract when you're doing that assessment of significant increase in credit risk on the guaranteed asset, is consistent with the approach in the standard for collateral. The standard points out in several places that collateral and financial guarantee contracts are all part of sort of types of credit enhancements. And as explained in example 3 of IFRS 9, the assessment of a significant increase in credit risk is made irrespective of the value of the collateral, so it doesn't impact your assessment. In addition, excluding recoveries from financial guarantee contracts is also consistent with the guidance in paragraph B5517 of IFRS 9. And this is the guidance which gives some examples that notes that you may look at information about collateral guarantees or other credit enhancements when you are making your assessment, but it emphasises that this is to determine how they influence the borrower's economic incentive to make scheduled contractual payments. That is, how they influence the risk of the borrower defaulting rather than the collateral or a guarantee itself defaulting. So be interested to hear your views on the issue.
Okay, so who's the lucky person?
Me. So I think in looking at this, you know, the standard is quite clear that you need to look at the risk of default and the increase in that, and that collateral should only be looked at when you're looking at the measurement of your expected losses. An issue that we've been debating a fair bit in the Canadian market is an issue around financial guarantees, and it's particularly over a mortgage product, where we cannot issue certain mortgage products without a financial guarantee from the Government of Canada. So we believe the risk of default on these is extremely low because, you know, ultimately you're looking to the Government of Canada to make whole in the event the mortgage goes bad. The other scenario that we've been looking at is where you have an off-balance sheet or an SPV, and you're granting credit to that SPV, but in underwriting that credit, you're actually looking to a guarantee of a third party. And in that scenario, when you're doing your credit adjudication process, while you're making the loan to the SPV, you're looking at the parent guarantee. And in that scenario, should you be looking at the significant decline or your, you know, the probability of default on the based on the guarantee, not to who you've actually lent the money to. So I think, you know, we appreciate what's in the literature, but we're, you know, trying to separate, to be honest, instruments that are, you know, supported by collateral, because I agree you have to go through the process of realizing your collateral fair value can change, versus a financial guarantee from a third party. So we're looking at that and are sort of wrestling with it within the standard.
Do you think that the words in IFRS 9 make a distinction between those two things?
I don't think so, but we're looking for ways, to be honest.
All right. Wayne.
So
honest response.
Yeah.
Thank you.
we understand the paper. The two elements we're struggling with is exactly what does contractually integrated mean? And a lot of loans are taken out only on condition that there's a guarantee issued with them. And is it just the fact, and we also would have looked at the, I can't read it, B5.5.17K, where a guarantee is given by a parent to a subsidiary. So we looked at a lot of the mortgage guarantee products and the external guarantees, but it equally comes up, even if I look at my own situation, I live in a world of asset protection. I'm an audit partner. I have no assets. So I guarantee I personally guarantee loans, either for my spouse or for various family trusts. The loan was only issued and priced because of my earnings and my guarantee. Now, does it make a difference to it whether I can give the money to my wife in order to service the debt, or I can give the money to a family trust to service the debt, or I'll just pay the debt directly? And I'm struggling to see the principle of where it goes into a 17K as to whether there's been a significant deterioration in that loan. The loan was issued and priced based on me guaranteeing it, or whether the external guarantees from a top-up insurer. The banks aren't worried about a significant deterioration. But this standard, as I read the standard, this will now say that it's gone into bucket two. It's going to mean the banks are going to have to now monitor something they don't really have to monitor. And the answer will be zero. You know, the loss provision will be zero. But as a consequence, we're going to have a significant amount of disclosure that very likely will include additional disclosure to say, ignore this disclosure. And going on to the disclosure regime, I'm not sure whether this is a useful consequence.
This is going to be one of the circumstances where I'm going to pull us back, I'm afraid, to what the words in the standard say, as opposed to what we might want the words in the standard to say. So Helen was very, very well behaved because she was honest in saying that the words in the standard don't distinguish between the two, but you would have liked the answer to be different. So can we focus firstly on whether other people have got different readings of the words and then maybe come back to what we then do?
Sorry. I just thought, I think further wording there to me is quite clear. I think I want to come back to Wayne's example, and I think that's a good example where the actual collateral actually influences the probability of the account going into default. So I think in the example that he put forward, where whatever guarantor ends up ensuring that the payment does happen, then it does change the probability of default. I don't think it actually influences the wording of the standard. I think that is still clear. But I think in that case, there is an influence which needs to be taken.
And I think in that case, and I was trying to pick up Kay to see what it said, given that you were referring to it, and I think that's exactly what Kay was trying to get at, from my recollection, that it's trying to get at the fact that would the guarantor actually do something to support the obligor to prevent them going into default in the first place, that means you don't actually need to go to the guarantee per se. And I think that the words in 9 would tell you in that case, because it affects the risk of the actual obligor defaulting, that is relevant, but sort of not more generally. So yeah, I'd agree with that observation, but I'm not sure that helps too much in the other examples that are being raised. George?
So we went implemented IFRS in Canada, and we talked about the derecognition standards. They were in IS 39. There was a big argument about, do we have something that's a guaranteed mortgage or a mortgage with a guarantee? You say, are you just splitting words? You're trying to be cute. But I don't think so, because I think there is a difference. If that guarantee is required by law, the mortgage cannot be issued without it. is it really an attribute of the security? And by law, it has to be done that way. And is that different than someone who goes and issues mortgages and then later, for risk purposes, decides to bulk insure at its own choice something because that's what they want to do from a risk perspective? And so I think there is a difference in this Canadian example with the mortgage insurance that we think we'd like to find a way, and I think they're probably, because of that distinction which I just made, and the implication, of course, is for banks who do apply AIRB, who do PD substitutions all over the place, this is going to end up being, again, a very practical problem. All those PD substitutions are going to have to be undone just for the purpose of figuring out between bucket one and bucket two. And we're not, you know, I think the issue there is that really something that people consider to be material disclosure, that distinction between the two buckets when the measurement would be the same? I see the regulators would like to speak, so I hope.
Oh, sorry, Karen.
I can go after you go, Karen. First of all, IRB and PD substitution isn't relevant. That's a capital treatment, and it doesn't have anything to do with the accounting. And as you know, Basel is also reviewing all of its IRB, and I believe that PD substitution has been found to be one of those issues that has created divergence from different exposures and is on the list for a consistent application globally. So that, I think, is off the table, and I don't think the regulatory treatment should influence the account. On the accounting side, I think from my understanding of the standard, the words are quite clear. And I thought the intention was, the objective was, to show how credit migrates through, regardless of what the impact to the allowance would be. And I think from a regulatory perspective, we were very clear that we'd like to see that in IFRS 9, not just what happens to the allowance. And the reason is because the person who gives the guarantee might not be there in the end.
Yes, as Karen just said, we have to focus on the accounting. However, even if we talk about the credit risk management side of it, because we know that this standard is also about or affects credit risk management, and we think about situations, I mean, trying to think about situations where PD substitution or LGD adjustment or even the calculation of double default probabilities might be necessary. I tend to think that it all depends on the business model of each bank, and trying to think of an extreme example where this type of situations might be necessary, or this type of calculations or of alternative calculations might be necessary. I think of central bank refinancing operations. If, for instance, in central bank refinancing operations, when it comes to the management of credit risk stemming from those operations, there is a calculation of the double default probability. But the fact is that that calculation is conducted because if you look at the business of the central bank, it's not about lending, it's not about granting credit, it's about providing liquidity and managing the structural liquidity shortfall. So extending that or extrapolating that to the banking business, to the private banking business, I would say there could be limited instances in which there might be a case for a double default probability calculation or a PD substitution in terms of credit risk if the business model is not related or is related not only with the granting of credit but with other types of things, also depending on the characteristics of the instrument. But in any case, that would be reflected in the credit risk management of that instrument. So the pricing and the rest of the characteristics of the rest of the terms of that loan would already reflect that double default probability. So turning to the standard itself, I don't think there's any case to replace what's already being said. I mean, as Karen just said, the standard talks about the evolution or is thinking about the evolution in credit risk, whether that's in the credit risk of the debtor or it has to incorporate characteristics of the, because of the characteristics of the instrument itself and the business itself, it has to incorporate characteristics of the of the of the obligor. Well, that could be the case, but it doesn't affect the requirement to track the evolution of credit risk. So,
Jörg.
Just to add, I think usually when banks grant money, they usually look whether the obligor is in the position to fulfill its obligation and is in the position to repay. And I do not know many cases where credits were granted because we had a very strong collateral situation or very strong guarantor behind. I think in the first place there must be the analysis, is the obligor to whom I grant money in the position to repay the money and not because there's some fallback solution at the end, which in the end reduces my losses to zero. And I think this is well reflected in the concept of the expected loss calculation. I have a PD which reflects the likelihood of default of my obligor. I can take into account collaterals in my LGD, which brings the risk down close to zero. I think this is exactly the case with the Canadian mortgage securities.
Just quickly to add, I agree with what Georg is saying, and I also agree that primarily it could result in disclosure because the provision will be zero. But there are instances where your LGD will not turn to zero because of the collateral, and then the shift from stage one to stage two will create an impact on the amount of the provision that's being carried. So we need to be cognizant about that, and that's why I think the flow issue and what the standard requires also comes in. So it's not just a disclosure issue, it can turn into an actual number being having an impact in the P&L.
John.
Thanks. I generally agree. I agree with where the paper has landed, where the staff have landed. I agree with what Jörg said, that you would generally look at the obligor's ability to repay, but not in all circumstances. There are certain circumstances where you may not be particularly interested in the obligor, and I can think of parent company guarantees to subsidiaries borrowing off banks, where the banks would not necessarily lend to the subsidiary without the parent guarantee, and they are looking to the parent guarantee. And also situations where banks may have sold loans to bad banks, where they would not have done it if they didn't have the state guarantee, and the only reason they did it was it was maybe a state requirement, but secondly they did it because they needed to repo the paper, and to repo the paper they needed the state guarantee. So I think the paper lands in the right place. I just wonder for certain circumstances whether there's a unit of account issue we could look at. And certainly paragraph 98 of IFRS 13, looking at the fair value of liabilities, does talk about fair value and liability with a credit enhancement as one and being allowed. So I just wondered, is there something there? But just to maybe to go back to your point, Sue, you're talking about Helen, I think the standard is quite clear, but the way the paper lays it out is, I think, where the standard directs you. I just wonder, is that right for all circumstances, particularly the parent subsidiary position?
All right. Brian.
Thanks, Sue. I kind of echo John's thought there. I think it's probably... Just to come up with a couple examples off the top of my head, I think it's important not to talk about this in a way that would encourage people to ignore collateral. You think about a mortgage borrower, the value of their home significantly influences their willingness to repay that loan, right? If you've got equity in your home, you're much more likely to keep paying. If you don't, you're much more likely to walk away. I think another thing, particularly to John's point, is you might think about a business owner who takes out a loan under his own name, but his sole source of repayment is, and the collateral on the loan is, cash flows from the underlying business. And so there may not be a real distinction in that case between borrower and cash flows on collateral. So I know a common concept in the United States is primary source of repayment versus secondary source of repayment. I think to John's point, that may be a meaningful concept when thinking about this is, are we sort of getting substance over form here and saying, well, that's really collateral? Well, if the collateral is the primary source of repayment and the legal structure of the credit is such that it's, you know, you have sort of a non-substantive borrower, does that really make sense that you would, because you'd almost initially put, it would almost be a credit impaired origination at that point if you thought about it like that. So I think that that idea of primary source repayment, secondary source repayment may be an important concept for this.
Okay.
I just wanted to come back to John and Graham in terms of collateral and parent guarantees. And I think from a regulatory perspective, when we looked at the work to create the expected credit loss model, we were very concerned about considering collateral and determining credit risk. And I think from a regulatory credit risk management perspective, we didn't think that that should be considered, because really we wanted to see that the credit risk is happening regardless, because things can happen with collateral and guarantees. And if you grant the loan based on what you think will be there and it's not there, then it's a surprise. And what we didn't want in this standard was surprises. We wanted this standard to be forward-looking. So from our perspective, we don't think that there is exclusions of collateral or guarantees that should be considered in terms of the determination of the credit risk.
Chris?
I agree with many of the comments made, and I think that when you read the standard, it's reasonably clear that the exclude the guarantee protection in determining whether there is credit risk. And just in some of these situations, we talk about parent, subsidiary structures, etc. I mean, you can get a slightly different fact pattern where you have sort of co-borrowers with joint several liability. But I think if you had that situation, you get a different answer, because then you're saying, well, I've got two primary obligors, and I consider the credit risk of both, and jointly in terms of making the assessment. In terms of interpreting 5517, I mean, the only way that I could see that you could consider getting some separate answer is if you wanted to try and be very creative with the definition of default, because it talks about whether the guarantee would reduce the probability of default occurring, and the standard doesn't define default. So, you know, if you said something like, okay, well, I've made a loan to somebody for this type of loan, and in terms of what my definition of default is, I'm going to consider, firstly, whether the person who makes the loan doesn't pay and their capacity to pay, but also whether I might recover fully under the guarantee within a certain period. And then you sort of you could get an argument that, yep, in terms of its form, satisfies 5517, but I don't think that was
hopefully
really
we'd
the
all agree that was a disingenuous application of IFRS 9. Yes. Kumar?
Just quickly coming back to the point Graham was making, I think you were talking about the phenomenon of keys in the post in the US when the equity value comes down. Absolutely agree, that does affect. And I think the standard does cover that. That's when we say that the collateral value and the PD can be.
I was just going to refer to a side issue that's also referred to in the staff paper, and Graham referred to it. I think it's important to consider, although it's not the bulk of the fact pattern that's being questioned. It's the issue on the repayment incentive. I think it's example number 5, where it clearly states, and I think it's really important to consider this, that those incentives are affected basically where the terms of the loan favor that kind of situation. What I mean is, if the loan is granted on very high loan to values at origination, that loan is, or the incentives by borrowers, that loan is going to be more sensitive to declines in house prices than other. Except in those cases, or in extreme shocks in the price of the collateral, I don't think the equity of the borrower into the mortgage, for instance, really has a bearing on the incentive. What I mean is that, again, this is a relative model. You have to consider what happens at origination. So if the loan is granted on very aggressive terms, that's more likely to be affected, or the incentives of the borrower are more likely to be affected by what happens on the price of collateral.
OK.
Okay, I'm going to try and wrap up. So I think that most agreed, whether or not they liked the implications of it, that IFRS 9 is clear that it makes a distinction between the default on the instrument and the effect of collateral or financial guarantee contracts. So the focus is on the risk of the default, so that collateral is only really relevant to the assessment of the significant increase in credit risk as opposed to the measurement of expected credit losses if it were, for example, to have an effect on the likelihood of the default occurring, which is what's reflected in 5517. And I know that some of you don't like that, but I think that that was the design of IFRS 9 and for the reasons that I think Pablo and Karen in particular focused on, and also Jurg, which is we thought that there was information value, which people may disagree with, but we felt there was information value in knowing to which extent you were really relying on the support as opposed to the obligor by moving between stage one and stage two, and so that's what IFRS 9 is capturing. I think the only thing that I sort of will leave open, I don't want us really to discuss this, but just as a thought, a closing thought, is that when we use terms like integrated guarantee, I've got no idea really what that means, and I suspect it could mean different things to all of us in the room if I was to give you an exam question and you had to write an answer, so I'm always nervous what that means. And also I can't pretend to understand exactly how all these guarantee structures work. I think the design of IFRS 9 is really focusing on this concept that you would have a sort of technical default, if you like, by the borrower, and then as a consequence the guarantee kicks in and support is provided, so you sort of have a default and in an instant you might get support. If the structure was such that in effect that guarantee kicked in before there was even a technical default, then I think maybe there could be something to look at there, but I think that would be the only thing I would add, and I don't want to really go into it further than that. That's a risky comment, but just a thought, because I think it's all about sort of default followed by collateral recovery is the design concept that we've got there. Now I think we have earned our break, so let's have a 15-minute break until 11:30. Thank you.